Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Freedom!
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. And Christopher?
Yes, sir.
Good to have you back.
It's great to be back after a few weeks away.
We had Mr. Living Well with us for the last 3 weeks or so, and you've been taking a big test, right?
Mr. Living Well.
Well, that's his bon vissuto, literally means lived well.
Great.
You know, my name means head of rock or something like that, you know? And
well, as long as mine doesn't mean bang on rock.
I don't know what O'Shea means, but I'm sure it's nothing.
Son of O'Shea. Yeah.
Son of O'Shea.
Son of O'Shea, I mean, yeah, there you go.
There you go. Anyway, we've got a guest tonight.
We do.
Before we go to that guest, and you're going to introduce the guest, tell us a little about what we're doing and what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah.
I want to give you a little Drew's view that's kind of a prelude to what we're talking about tonight.
Sure.
And that is that I've been in this financial services, investments industry for 35 years, hard to believe. I started in 1979. And the one thing I learned it quick in the early years of 1979, 1980, is that when you manipulate a market, ultimately you make a lot of money on the upside of the manipulation. But when the manipulation ends, it usually isn't pretty. And in 1980, the classic was the Hunt brothers. The Hunt brothers drove the price of silver up from the low single digits all the way up to $53 an ounce in 1980. They became multi-billionaires, the richest men in the world at that time. And then their manipulation and cornering of the silver market collapsed as everyone brought silver out of the basement and sold it on the open market. And the Hunt brothers went from billionaires down to almost bankrupt. Anyway, so... Why don't you give us a little about who we're going to be talking to tonight, and we'll get to what the point of the Drew's view and who our guest is.
Sure, yeah, it's a great opening to what we're doing. We do have John Malden, just a little bit about him. He's chairman of Malden Economics. That's maldeneconomics.com, an economics and investment strategy research firm. He's also heads up a registered investment advisor. He's a renowned financial expert. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He's pioneered online commentary.
But what did he really do?
There you go. So he's written Code Red, right?
Okay.
He's also, he has seven children. That's, I think, important to say.
Yeah.
It says on the book cover, five are adopted. And he lives in Dallas. And
now
he wrote this book.
Important. He lives in Texas.
He lives in Dallas. And he wrote this book called Code Red. And I saw a little exchange between he and Steve Forbes talking about why the name and what's the core of the book. I'm just going to read that. And so if you saw the movie A Few Good Men, there was a phrase in there that was used, kind of the core of what was happening in the movie, of why people would be in charge, some people would be in charge, soldiers would be in charge in there, and it was called Code Red. Well, let me read it here. I'm quoting, well, Jack Nicholson famously felt that he had to protect America. He was in charge, and so he issued his famous Code Red, and the line was, you need me on that wall. And at the beginning of the book, John Malden says, I paraphrase his speech as if it were Ben Bernanke or now Janet Yellen. You need me on that committee. You want me on that central bank. Yes, you work for savers and creditors, but I'm responsible for whole economies. I have greater things to worry about. So the central banks of the world in 2008 had to issue a Code Red, which was essentially to try to get the misfit soldier to fall in line.
There you go. That's great. John, is that true?
You pretty much got it nailed. If you just go ahead and read the rest of it, we can just skip the interview. You know, I can go back to my writing and work, and you're doing a great job.
There you go. Well, we appreciate you being with us here, John, tonight, and we wanted to talk about your book, Code Red, because we think it's probably one of the most important topics in the economic system today, and that is what central banks are doing. So give us your synopsis of what do you see is happening right now, just as a prelude to the rest of the interview here.
Well, you have to understand that central banks around the world have been captured by the academic and bureaucratic world that believes in an economic theory called Keynesianism. And we don't want to get too deep in the weeds for listeners, but there's a fundamental debate that started in the 30s between Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, and John Maynard Keynes over how the world worked. What was the nature of the economy? What should governments do? What should policies look like? And Keynes believed that government should intervene and should be proactive. And specifically, when the Keynesians, when the whole concept of GDP was developed in the 40s, and it got co-opted to say that that the economy is government spending and consumer spending. And if all you've got is 70% consumer spending, 20% government, and 10% investment and other stuff that they can throw in, then the two big dials are, what do we do to increase consumer spending? Well, we want to increase the leverage in the system. We want to make rates lower so people will spend more. And so we end up encouraging people to borrow more money at ever lower rates. And that's what's happened. Now, we've come to the end of the ability pretty much throughout the developed world of governments to be able to borrow money at rational numbers. And it's increasingly happening. It hasn't happened in the U.S. yet, but if we don't figure out how to get our deficit under control, that same thing will happen to us. And that means for central bankers, well, they're just going to double down. That means we want to print more money. We want to monetize more debt. We want to keep rates low because for them, lower rates mean higher employment. That's part of their equation. Now, the real world is actually more than just consumer spending. It's businesses. It's production. It's manufacturing. It's farms. And those inputs, if you add those back into the system, the economy roughly doubles. And you find out that private production, intermediate production, is 50% of the economy. That takes consumer spending down to about 40 and government down to about 10. Well, now the biggest chunk is businesses and private production. And that's where Hayek comes in, and he says, we should be twisting the knobs to make private production easier, to make it easier for businesses to expand and grow, because that's what will truly create jobs.
So hold on there, right there, John.
So it actually all boils down to how we want to measure the economy.
Yeah, so we're going to...
Do you want to measure it as consumer spending, and that's a legitimate measure, or do you want to measure the entire economy, and that says that we need to be concerned about how our businesses, how the arteries and the veins and the blood are pumping?
Okay, so John, we got to hold on 1 second, and we're going to come back to that. But right now, I got to go to see what's traffic happening, and then we're going to get back and explore more of what you're saying—the difference between this consumer and business and so forth. So hold on, we're going to Maggie Hunter and traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Rich, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth, and we're with John Malden, and he wrote the book Code Red, and we're talking about, how the central banks, basically think that they're gods. I really believe they think that they are. You know, John, Alan Greenspan thought he was the maestro. I think he really bought into that concept, that he could orchestrate the economy. Do you believe he had a lot to do with the 2008 downturn?
That's a question that I've written about and thought about a great deal. There's a cast of about 8 or 9 characters that you have to consign blame for over the that crisis.
Really?
And I would get Greenspan down around the number four.
Really? Which one would you put at number one?
Number one was the rating agencies.
Ah.
They were the group that was supposed to be making everybody play nice in the sandbox, that were supposed to be making the rules and setting the standards. And they just failed miserably. The regulators who were supposed to be making sure that garbage wasn't being sold. I mean, the subprime stuff, everybody knows. We have ninja loans. There was no income, no jobs. Waiters at restaurants, you know, making $30,000 or $35,000 a year were borrowing multiple $350,000, buying multiple $350,000-$400,000 homes for no money down. Interest-only loans, trying to flip them.
We had a client.
We just keep going down the list. Yes, low rates made it easier, and Greenspan kept rates too low for too long. But the failure can't be laid solely at the feet of the Fed. There were lots of people with their fingers to the pie on that.
But the regulators almost always react in hindsight. I've never seen them react in foresight. Almost never.
Well, I don't disagree. Not disagreeing at all.
Congress too.
In this particular case, when you have people putting together, and I was writing about this in 2006. Okay. This wasn't like a surprise to those of us who looked at the actual contracts and going, oh, my God, these are frauds. They're shams. These will not be paid back because they were taking the triple B portion of these contracts and rolling them up and somehow recreating them as triple A. And, I mean, we could go into how they did it, but it was fraudulent, and people were making hundreds of millions, billions of dollars.
So were the rating agencies.
And that's just what they do when you let the inmates rule run the asylum.
Okay, so let's go to today, John, and let's talk about the Fed of today. They're holding rates well below the rate of inflation. They're destroying savers. I know lots of people are coming to me who have money in CDs, FDIC insured, saying, what can I do? And they want me to put it in junk bonds or whatever the case may be, and they have no idea what risk they're taking. This is happening day in and day out in the investment world right now.
Well, I mean, Bernanke and now Janet Yellen very, very clearly wanted, by keeping rates low, by putting these savers in financial jeopardy, wanted people to move out the risk curve. They want them to finance ever increasingly riskier investments so that, in their opinion, the economy will be jump-started. It is a false assumption. It's what they've done, and I think actually Janet Yellen is probably very uncomfortable with this. Bernanke, not so at all. They basically made people who own stocks, people who are rich, people who are investment bankers and bankers, the money. It hasn't trickled down to Main Street. And I do believe that we'll see another round of quantitative easing in our future, but I will almost be willing to bet you that whatever Janet Yellen does when we have the next recession, and there's always another recession, it's not going to look like what we've done in the past. I don't know whether it'll be, you know, Ben Bernanke's direct helicopter drop, but I think she was very uncomfortable with making the wealthier even wealthy. I mean, when we look at the left screaming about income inequality, a great deal of it has been because of central bank policy.
Well, do you think the central bankers and the politicians saved the world in 2008, 2009 with the things they did?
Well, in our book, we called it, like, you know, asking the arsonist to put out the fire. I mean, yes, they saved it. But they were the ones who helped light it. So, giving them credit for saving the world is, you know, like giving the arsonist credit after the building is burning for, you know, carrying the bucket of water and throwing it on the fire.
Would you say that they were like the drug rehabilitation person, giving person more drugs so that they didn't continue to struggle with no drugs?
That is what I think happened in 2010. In 2008, late 2009, we had a true liquidity crisis. And about, in my humble opinion, the only real reason for a central bank is to be there in the middle of a liquidity crisis. The purpose of a central bank is to provide liquidity at a price in the middle of a liquidity crisis. And the central bank did that.
Agreed.
Now, so QE1, I have no philosophical problem with. They should have done it. You know, I actually have no problem with the federal government, you know, running up $1 trillion of extra debt. I have a problem with how they spent it. They used it on consumer spending rather than actual construction jobs, actually building something for our future. I mean, if we had spent $1 trillion on fixing our infrastructure, on bridges and roads, and that type of thing, our children would at least have something. We took that $1 trillion and we spent it.
Right.
And so now we owe the debt.
What about buying stock in?
We didn't get the jobs. We did not get the trickle down, effects that the Keynesians, promised us would happen.
What about buying stock in the banks and brokers to save them from going under?
That was distasteful in the extreme. My personal opinion, and by the way, I had a very, very long dinner with John Boehner in way into the evening about 3 years ago now. And somebody asked him about, okay, the next time we have a crisis, are you going to save the banks? You're going to come back in with a TARP II? And this was a very nice man. He was making jokes. He was full off color. It was a you know, rough crowd. But I tell you, the anger on his face was amazing. I mean, it's like it transformed him, and his basic, you know, gestures and language can be distilled down to, there is no way in God's green earth we'll ever give those banks another nickel. The next time they can go pound sand. I mean, he got talked into that deal, and he clearly, in looking back at it, was angry about it. And as long as John Boehner or anybody else associated with that old TARP has any memory, the next time there's a banking crisis, the bank's shareholders will be wiped out in their entirety. And my suspicion is that we will see the bondholders take significant haircuts if their banks are not creditworthy.
Now that would have been the best result.
That would have been what we should have done the last time.
That would have been too big to fail. Clearly dealt with once and for all.
I mean, the simple, you know, I mean, you wipe out shareholders. It's just like any other business going bankrupt. It's like what would happen if a small bank went bankrupt. You wipe out the shareholders. The bondholders get wiped out. There is an argument to be made that we should have taken care of the preferreds. We did anyway, but we should have taken care of the preferreds because ultimately we would have come back to taxpayers anyway. But the reality is we should have wiped them all out, replaced all of their board of directors, replaced senior management, and broken those puppies up.
Yep. You got to hold on for me, John.
Okay.
You know, I got to keep taking these breaks, you know. I'm not allowed to call them breaks, but I got to keep taking these pauses, unfortunately. We're going to come right back and get into what you're suggesting people do for the future. Right now, we got to go traffic Mackie Hunter. Come on, Maggie.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And this is Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with John Malden. We're talking about his new book, Code Red. And one of the parts of the book is talking about, well, what do you do? What do you do? So how do you play this? So you got all these guys and all these people pulling all these great miracle. They think they've got it all figured out. And they've got everything fixed, and they're, you know, slowly but surely moving things along. And, you know, John, one of the things you talk about in the book is, you know, there are things you can do. And so what is your prognosis for all this manipulation the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government are doing, and central banks around the world, for that matter, and governments around the world? What do you think the prognosis for the future is first? And then we'll get into what do we do about it.
Well, we have two great transformations coming about over the next 10 to 15, 20 years, and they're competing with each other. It's basically a race by the governments and central banks of the developed world to destroy wealth versus that of humanity, of our entrepreneurs and businesses to create wealth. We're going to see a technological revolution that is going to make us gasp when we look back in 10 or 20 years. We will see more change in the next 10 to 15 years than we saw all of last century. It's like we're going to see change on steroids. And it's going to be positive. I mean, we're seeing not one major new technology, but tens of thousands of improvements almost daily, weekly, coming on all sorts of distributed technology so that we're constantly improving. We're becoming more efficient. It's what Schumpeter called, you know, creative destruction. But we're becoming more productive, and that's positive for humanity. And, you know, if you look at the robotics and automation fields, just to take an example, and if you create an index, which has been done, out of robotics and automation, you find that it's up like six times more than the S&P 500 over the last 12 years. I mean, that's where the growth is in the new world, the new technology. Conversely, we have governments coming to the end of their ability to borrow money. In the United States, we're going to have a conversation about how much health care do we want and how do we want to pay for it. Right now, we have voted to have unlimited amounts of health care, and we want somebody else to pay for it. And it's just not going to happen. So we're going to have to restructure our whole concept of retirement and entitlements. And it's going to be a very, very wrenching experience for us. But I think we come out on the other side of that much the better. But we've got to get through it. Same thing with Europe. Europe created this Frankenstein monster called the euro, and the only way they're going to be able to keep the euro together is to mutualize their debt, and which means that the individual countries are going to have to give up their sovereignty and look more like states in the United States.
That ain't going to happen.
Well, you know something? You say that, but you have to understand, we're talking, this is a political decision, not an economic decision. And the voters of Greece decided to stay in the euro when economically they should have left. They now have 25% unemployment, their kids have 50% unemployment, and they don't want to leave the euro. They have this image, and I travel in Europe a lot. I go over there. They have this dream of a united Europe. And they just don't want to let it go. Now, there's significant chunks large chunks of the population of Europe that are ready to walk. So it's just how much pain are really the big four countries, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, how much pain are their populations willing to take? Because it's going to be a lot of pain. Germany's going to have to end up taking enormous amounts of debt on to help fund the rest of the world. They're going to see higher inflation. They're going to have to just kind of swallow a lot of problems. But if they break the euro up, it also costs trillions of euros, and it's a debacle for Germany. I mean, they have no good choices.
No, you're right. You're right.
I mean, Japan, as we spent two long chapters in the book talking in Code Red, and we did it in Endgame as well, talking about Japan. Japan is getting ready to monetize 70% of their national debt. What would be like will be eight or nine trillion equivalent dollars in Japan, and that money's going to flood into the world. Is going to take the value of the yen down. I mean, I have my mortgage hedged in yen. I think Abe and Kuroda-san are perfectly committed to destroying the value of the yen, and so I'm going to let them pay for half my mortgage.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
It's a reasonable trade to me. And, so we have a world that has too much debt. I mean, we all know what happens when you have too much debt. You got to figure out how to restructure things.
So the likely answer is going to be that they're going to try to create more and more inflation.
Well, yes and no. And I don't want to be noncommittal here. I mean, they would like to see some inflation. I don't think anybody wants to go back to the 70s again. We don't want to have to find our inner Volcker. For those of us who lived through the 70s and then the recessions in the 80s and 82, I mean, I remember paying 18% prime for a loan and happy to get it.
Right.
For my business, because I was buying paper that was going up at 25 and 30%. it was a crazy period of time that I just as soon never repeat again. But I don't think we want to go back through that period. But that being said, could we see 4 or 5% inflation in the U.S. in 3 or 4 years? Absolutely. Absolutely. And at that point, they'll start having to raise rates and pull in their balance sheets. And there will be voices in this country coming from academic sources all over the country and people that want easy monetary policies talking about how the central bank is destroying the future, which is what happened to the 70s, and the central bank listened rather than doing what central banks are supposed to do, which is maintain the value of prices. I mean, a stable price mechanism within reason is what central banks are supposed to do, and to provide liquidity in the middle of a crisis. Other than that, they should back out and not get involved.
But in the United States, they have a dual mandate.
Well, you know, and they use that dual mandate to allow them to do what they would like to do anyway because of their philosophy. But if you start seeing 5% inflation, that dual mandate is going to become suspiciously problematic, and they're going to see the primary mandate, which is stable money and stable prices, take a bigger and bigger role. Right now, they can talk about why unemployment is something that we have to continue to work on, and why that's why we're providing low rates, because inflation is at the 1.5 to 2% level, at least the official rate. So I don't think we're going to go back to hyperinflation. I don't think we're going to see the dollar destroyed. In fact, my view is that the dollar is going to become the strong currency in the world over the next few decades. I mean, what's going to happen is as this energy revolution takes a hold and we become energy independent, and when we actually start exporting natural gas, we're going to have a positive trade balance. It'll shock the world. The dollar, which is the currency that the world trades in, will be in huge demand, and the value of the dollar will actually go up. If we could balance our budget in the same process, if we could actually get a White House and a Congress that would say, this time we're really serious about balancing the budget. I mean, we had a Republican Congress and president the last time that they were in control. They spent like drunken sailors. If they had just merely continued the policies of Clinton and Gingrich, we would have come into a 2008 crisis if the Fed and all the other stuff happened. We could have borrowed a trillion or $2 trillion. Nobody would have cared. Nobody would have blinked. It would have been fine. No, but the problem was we had already let the debt run up, and now we have a problem. We need to go back to realizing that government finances are not significantly different in the long term than family finances. You need to make more than you spend.
All right. We've got to hold on for us, John, because we've got to take this last break. Then we're going to come back and get some of the investment ideas and so forth. But right now, we've got to go to Mark Thibodeau. We'll be right back. John Moulton, take it away, Mark.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. And before we get back to John Moulton, I just have to let everybody in the area know that there's a severe thunderstorm warning until 7:42 for Baltimore County, Howard County, and Carroll County. So be on the lookout. Be careful. But right now, we're finishing our interview with John Moulton. We only have about 6 minutes left. John publishes a lot of great articles you can get on his blogs, MauldinEconomics.com, Maulden, M-A-U-L-D-I-N, Economics.com, and FrontlineThoughts.com, FrontlineThoughts.com. Did I get those right, John?
Those are right. Just Google John Moulton. I'll show up. They can stick their email address in. And they get my weekly letters for free. I do a couple of them. They meet one of my 1 million closest friends.
Yeah. And you also had just three of the articles I picked up on there that I thought were great to read. Most Dangerous Woman in the World, Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF. And I don't even want to mention what that article's about because you'll get people so freaked out and scared what you say in that article. 60-year super cycle of debt in developed nations and poverty matters to capitalists and why. Inequality and all this talk about inequality. I mean, we could talk all day about those things.
I write about a wide variety of stuff.
You do, and it's great.
The cool thing about my letter is that I get to write about whatever I want to that week. It's free, so if you're not paying for it, I write it because I find it intellectually challenging and fun. And we cover a pretty wide variety of topics.
And you also have someone that people can pay for that can be beneficial for your investment strategies and so forth. You have a lot of great stuff on this website, so I strongly encourage people. I find it fascinating. I signed up for it, so I think all of our listeners ought to consider it.
So, well, thank you. You're very kind.
Hey, John, so just in this last 4 minutes or so, you had some ideas. So Code Red, we've got these problems. We've got this central banks doing all these things. If you were an investor, which you are, what should people be thinking about right now? You've already told them, short the yen. What else?
Well, the problem as an investor is you know, going to cash, putting in your mattress, and pulling the cover over your head is not really a viable option today because you're losing ground to inflation and everything else. I would make sure that I have some type of hedge, some risk analysis on my portfolio that says, here's where I'm going to move to the sideline, move to cash. Here's how much risk I'm willing to take. Here's my tolerance. I like things that pay me money. I like companies that pay dividends. Get outside of the United States. Stop picking in your U.S. box. There are companies all over the world that pay 6, 7, 8% dividends. And they're good, solid companies. They just happen to be in countries that, you know, aren't everybody's favorite today. There are income opportunities in real estate and in other types of investments. Today, I think the environment that we're in, if you can find investments in private equity or businesses that will pay you 7, 8, 9%, be happy. Go home. Take it. You know, this isn't a world where we're going to make the returns that we made in the 90s or even the early 2000s. Those days are gone for a while. They'll come back in the 20s, in the 2020s. I mean, I think we're going to go through one more, you know, pretty serious correction in the stock market when we have the next recession. And that will be, as I was writing in 98 and 2003, that will be the end of the secular bear, which typically lasts about 17 years on average.
Well, a lot of people would argue we're not.
To stop them, and then we can be bullish again.
A lot of people would argue we're in a bull market, John.
What?
A lot of people would argue we're in a bull market because we're well past the previous highs of 2007.
Okay. I define bull and secular bear by valuations, not by price. And if you start looking at valuations and you judge markets by valuations, we're nowhere near a bottom. So of this long-term, well, I think it's a long-term secular bear. Because what you find out is there are these big long cycles when you look at valuations. Now, price movement in the middle of these, you get big bear markets and big bull markets, a cyclical bull market, which is where we're at today, no question about it. And you, and when you're in a secular bear, it's a trader's market. You don't buy and hold. We'll come to a buy and hold event after the next recession, I think, where we can say, okay, I'm going to buy and I'm going to live through the crisis. I mean, if you bought in 82, you didn't want to sell no matter what bear market you were in all the way to 99. Okay?
Right.
So, we, you know, it runs in cycles.
So wait, hold on, John.
The cycle will end, and we get to be, you know, rabid bulls again. But today we have to be cautious optimists.
We're out of time, but I wanted to tell everybody again. John Maldin, just Google that name, Maldin, and you'll see his John Maldin Economics or MaldinEconomics.com frontline thoughts. Get on there, get on his newsletter, and I think it'll be incredibly beneficial. John, I really appreciate your time. I knew it was a sacrifice to you to give us this time tonight, but I thought it was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, sir.
Well, we thank you. And this is Money, Rich, and Wealth. Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Thank you and good night.